Old Jesse, Reel 3. When you arrived on board HMS Belfast, what was your rank?
Engineer Maths Officer, grade 5, which means a supernumerary grade for training before being let loose on the machinery. And I was grade 5 for some months. It was formally meant to be 6 months, but it was probably less than 6 months. And I was then inaugurated into the watch system so that when the ship was at sea, I could take part in the driving of the ship. One spent so many months in the boiler rooms in aiming to obtain a boiler room watchkeeping certificate. And the main part of this work was in starting up the boiler room machinery. The actual driving of the boilers was done by stokers, with a chief stoker, stoker petty officers and stokers. But an ERA was assigned to the watch to start up the machinery, see that it's running properly, and generally hover in the background. He took no part in driving the boilers. From that point of view, it was fairly boring. Boilers are quite straightforward. You just pump oil in and out comes steam, providing you get the water in the right quantities to take the place of the steam. So that was fairly boring. And I obtained my watchkeeping certificate well before time and became an engine room fourth class confirmed. I then took part in training for the engine room driving, which was a lot more complicated and required a lot more practice and experience. The driving of the engines was done by a throttle watchkeeper, and he stood by a set of throttles, a huge big hand wheels, which open and close large steam valves to the turbines. It's not the operation of the turbines that's the trick of the business. It's the keeping of the vacuum at the correct level, the condensate at the correct level, the lubrication and going properly, feed pumps, the air condensers and that sort of thing. There's a lot of things going on all at once and all changing at the same time, and you have one stoker to help you, so that when the telegraph rings and you have to change speed, you gradually admit more or less steam to the turbines, and you then have to watch that the stoker does his bit and you do your bit to adjust all the peripherals. There is a chief engine room artificer in charge of the whole, what's called the unit, the two engines in one engine room, and there is an engineer officer in charge of four engines and four boilers. And I suppose I was about 2 months learning to drive the turbine, and then I did it by myself. The three watch system was in use, which is one watch on and two watches off, with dog watches which breaks the cycle up. The worst set of watches is the middle watch, that's from the midnight to 4 a.m., followed by the afternoon watch, which is noon to 4 p.m., and then the first watch of the night, which is 8 p.m. to midnight. That's a long 12-hour day, and you're pretty exhausted at the end of it. It is almost paramount not to let people do longer than their 4-hour stint, because it's hot, it's noisy, and you can lose concentration. And for that reason, except in very extreme circumstances, even in action, people, during lulls in the action, people were moved around from watchkeeping in the engine rooms to a damage control task somewhere else in the ship to keep this rhythm going, if at all possible.
What did you do to maintain your concentration?
Write poetry. I can quote you a poem written on the 24th of December, just before the Scharnhorst action, which was 1943, Christmas 1943 sees me on Tiddley Bee. Christmas 1944 won't see me for dust no more. And that's a little jingle that I wrote for myself, and I've never forgotten it. But yes, writing poetry is one. The other distraction is that...
Sorry, your poetry is...
The other distraction is that if you have to drive the engines at a certain speed, in revolutions for every minute, then in 10 minutes you have to clock up on your counter 10 times that number. So 150 would become 1500, and the running counter always has to accumulate as many revolutions as are demanded in a given time, because otherwise the ship would not be going its set pace through the water, and the navigation is sometimes done by dead reckoning, where they depend on the propellers going around the exact number of times that are asked for. So that is a complicated piece of arithmetic that you have to distract you from the gauges. I also used to compose letters, not to write for real, but to get the sense of it done. And talking. You couldn't do much ordinary talking. You could bellow in somebody's ear, but at least that passed the time away.
How noisy was it?
Too noisy to talk as we are talking now. You had to bellow into somebody's ear. And the telephones were used by sound power telephones. You turn a handle to ring the bell at the other end, and shine a light at the other end. Then you put your head in a little soundproof booth to use the telephone, and that's as much as you could do. The telegraph bells were extremely loud and noisy because they had to attract your attention, and all the operations for the engines were done by telegraph, which is a man in the conning position winding a handle going ding dong ding dong ding dong ding to put the revolutions per minute up or down, and clang clang to go ahead or astern. It was all mechanical, no electrical communications at all. And the strangest thing, I took a party of Boy Scouts over the Belfast night, and I said the strangest thing is that the captain has to say down a voice pipe to a man down below what he wants to happen. And the man down below says to somebody else what has got to happen, and somebody else winds handles as to what's to happen. And it could be quite a minute before anything starts to happen. Nowadays, the captain moves a little lever and drives the engines direct himself, especially on passenger liners. However...
So you worked in the engine room?
Yes.
You worked repairing copper pipes?
Yes.
Anything else that you're working to?
Yes, I later took on the specialist job of air conditioning, and I went all around the ship looking after the air conditioning plant. I taught myself the steering mechanisms, and I could go and look after that. That was a fairly hairy job, because you had to go back through the captain's cabin to get to the steering gear, and he wasn't at all well pleased if you came plodding through in dirty boots. So you chose your moment when he was ashore to go and do anything on the steering gear. The interesting thing when you're in dock is that you have to go underneath the bottom of the ship and carry out fairly detailed inspections of all the underwater fittings, the valves and the ASDIC gear and the rudder and the screws. Anything that's under the ship you have to absolutely sign for and certify that it's in good order. Obviously if it's not, you do something about it. But But that's quite a nice little experience to walk under the ship and realise that you've got 10,000 tons sitting on top of bits of wood on top of you. A difficult one to keep right was the siren. The siren is up just behind the bridge and has always got a full head of steam on it. And if a tweak of a wire, the valve has to open and sound the siren, sound the foghorn, I should say. And it is always prone to leakage. And so the captain is never very pleased to have this wisp of steam blowing all over the bridge. And the chap in charge of the siren, of the foghorn, has got his work cut out to keep it in good working order. Unfortunately, I had that job for a couple of months, and I was very pleased to get rid of it. I must quote Arctic Steam. When the Arctic convoy started, it was very quickly found that people couldn't continue on the upper decks for any length of time doing any sort of action duty because of the freezing conditions and the accumulation of ice. And Arctic systems were inaugurated around the upper works of each ship, which is a system of steam pipes with lagging around them to keep these places free of ice and at least somewhat warm for the people who had to do their duties up there. I well remember one lookout watchkeeper, finishing his half-hour stint, coming down into the mess deck with all his Arctic clothing on, covered in ice, including his beard, and icy boots, and slipping on the ladder and measuring his length, the length of his companionway, and ripping open his back on a stanchion that was sticking out of the ladder by the time he got to the bottom. That was very nasty indeed. And that was common practice for these chaps. They could only spend half an hour on lookout duties. Right.
I was just going to ask you, we talked a little bit about the different areas of the engineering department. Could I just ask you to deal with the structure of that department from the top down
yes.
to the bottom?
The commandery was the chief, known by everybody as the chief. Beneath him, he had a number of lieutenants, one of whom was the senior lieutenant, and the senior lieutenant ran the whole of the engineering department on a day-to-day basis. He decided how things were done and by whom.
And that was Lieutenant Simpson?
And that was Lieutenant Simpson.
What do you remember about him?
A bright, sharp little man, very jovial, called me once by my Christian name to my utter joy and surprise, but very jovial, very pleasant, but very sharp. And if anybody took any liberties, they were very quickly made aware of it. We were a very efficient ship, in as much as everything worked. Later on, I can tell you of another experience I had, which was quite the opposite. But everything worked and everything was done right.
Below Commander Simpson, Lieutenant Simpson, how many other lieutenants were there?
I couldn't tell you exactly, but it would be something like 6 or 8. And some were in charge of the stokers. Some were in charge of the artificers, and they were watchkeeping, three watches, the same as us. And then there was the chief engine room artificer, who had two or three chief engine room artificers of rank below him. One would be a specialist in the boiler room, one would be a specialist on auxiliary machinery, such as the steering gear and the refrigerators, and the rest of us were just plainly artificers. But the chief engineer artificer, Bill Slade, was a highly experienced chap, very efficient, and he liked his rum, and it never got in the way of his duties. He sent his laundry by post back to Portsmouth, his shirt laundry, that is, by post back to Portsmouth, so that he always had nice white shirts. The rest of us had to do our laundry the hard way and hang it up in the boiler room to be dried and iron it on the mess tables. And coming back to my earlier note about not having any real place of your own, you had to watch your chance when everybody else was either ashore or doing their work around the ship to seize the chance to get a piece of mess table and do your ironing on. Very hard life. The stokers were under a chief stoker, and there were stoker petty officers and leading stokers and plainly stokers, and there were lots of them. In our mess, we had two stokers assigned as messmen. There was a little pantry by the side of the mess, and they worked in there. They did all the washing up, of course, and they took food to the galley in trays, peel potatoes and that sort of thing, and prepare it for the meal. And when it was cooked, they would collect it in these hot trays and put it into hot ovens so that it could be served out, or you went to the hatch and helped yourself to a plate, and it was served out and kept hot for any watchkeepers that came in late or early, for that matter.
Did they clean the mess as
and
well?
They cleaned the mess, yes.
Where was the artificer's mess?
Starboard side, at the back end of the upper deck, and I can show you on the model of the ship later. It's up there. Yes.
So artificers were a cut above the rest of the engineering department.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
Were they seen
trained
very much as that?
Yes, an artificer was a respected trade. And there were not only engine room artificers, there were ordnance artificers and electrical artificers, and later on fleet air arm artificers. That artificer was a man with a trade, and for the ordinary rank and file of sailors, he was therefore a superior being. Not to be saluted or anything of that sort, but got out of the way of. You'd still barge each other in the gangway, but nevertheless, his opinion and his directions were certainly taken full respect of.
We were talking about the structure of the engineering department.
Yes.
We talked about artificers.
Yes.
Stokers, engine room.
Yes.
Any other section of the engineering department?
No, that was about it. There were later on a grade called mechanicians, who in my later years I came to recognise as spannermen. They could take something apart and put it together, but could not repair it. And that's the difference. Then nowadays you have a car mechanic, but no car mechanic will ever repair a car. He takes things off and puts new pieces back on, and that is a mechanic. And so we had a grade called mechanicians, who were halfway between being a stoker and an artificer. And the word artificer means a maker.
The fact that you had people to look after you in the mess, for example,
yes,
you're almost on a par with a petty officer.
We were petty officers, or chief petty officers. When I became an engine room artificer grade 3, that is fully trained to take charge of the ships of a unit, the engines of a unit, that is to say, a unit was two engines and two boilers. And in action, they operated together, with isolated from the other unit. There were two units in the ship, isolated from the other unit, and able to keep itself going at full speed all by itself, and I was entitled to take charge of everything that went on in that unit. I was then given 3 buttons as a chief petty officer, but I was not a chief ERA, I was a chief petty officer, artificer grade 3. That was very much respected, a chap with 3 buttons on his sleeve, as distinct from crossed anchors.
How old were you?
23, I suppose. 24. I became a chief ERA at the age of about 28.
Going back to the Belfast, you mentioned that when you first arrived, you had to sleep in your workshop.
Yes.
Did that continue to be the case?
For quite some time, I progressed to a billet in a gangway so that I didn't have anything underneath me. Gangway below decks, that is, with armour plating above, was a through passage for everybody walking from one end of the ship to the other without going on the upper deck. So all night there were people walking to and fro, so it behoved you to pull your hammock up nice and tight, otherwise you kept getting bumps underneath. But it was quite comfortable. And the air was warm, never unduly cold, and there were lights, and there were bits of cable trays and things that you could put your book on and your cigarettes, and be quite comfortable once you're in your hammock. And I learned to tie a hammock up with a stretcher bar to keep the sides open, made up some sort of pillow along with the mattress and the blanket, and it was quite comfortable. But the other thing we had to learn was, I mentioned doing the hammock up in the morning at action stations of any time of the day or night. If you were in your hammock, and this would obviously be at night, you weren't allowed to sling a hammock by day. In the at night time, you had to be out and the hammock lashed up in 2 minutes, and that takes some doing. And in the morning, it's a routine in the morning at sea. You had action stations just before dawn, because at the lifting of the sun over the horizon is the most dangerous time, because anybody that's lurking for you can then silhouette you against the rising sun, and you didn't know he was there. So there's always dawn action stations. And of course, this is at some horrendous time, like 6 in the morning. And along would come the commander, the chief, who'd had a call from his skivvy, his marine skivvy, and was up before us. He would come along banging on the bottom of all the hammock, "Hello, me, lot, come along, action stations." And you had to jump out, lash your hammock up, and slip. You went to sleep in a shirt, underwear and socks. So you only had to pull trousers on and your overalls, and you were away.
Where was your action station?
Either on watch. And I always seemed to be doing the starboard forward throttle. Okay, I could do any of them, but that always seemed to be the one that I was assigned to. Either there, or to flood B turret, should it come into trouble, and to save the magazine exploding, I had to flood it and drown everybody down there. That was my action station. I took the locks off the wheels, the hand wheels, up on the deck outside the turret, and stood there ready to do that, or fight fires, or whatever else was to be done. That was one action station. And the other action station was down by the steering position, which was down in the very safe part of the ship, when there was also a gyro compass master, and there was also the transmitting station where all the calculations for setting the guns was done on a piece of machinery. And it was very interesting to stand, watch the men turning their wheels and doing this job, to watch the helmsman turning his wheel, and to watch the gyroscope pointing which way we were going. And I have to talk about that later on, perhaps. My job down there was to flood the high angle magazine, which was down underneath, if that got into trouble. That was my second action station. So in the course of an action, I would do one watch in the engine room, and when there was a lull, we would change round, and I would do another action station, and then maybe do another. Depends on the way things went.
And who ordered you to do which action station?
It was by a nod of the head. We knew what to do. Practice. We knew what to do. Everybody went. Nod of the head. Change shifts, and off you went.
You first joined the Belfast in 1943.
Yes.
Which month was that?
January.
January.
Yes.
And at that time she would have been just back into action after the...
Just back into action after being rebuilt from its sitting on a mine in Rosyth. Just back into action was working up, and we were all part of the working up process. And we would go out and do practice action stations, practice firing, practice sending away boats, practice absolutely everything. Until we went off on our first mission, and I well remember that. It was absolutely glassy, flat, calm. And I thought, well, this is sea life. I don't mind this. Absolutely flat, glassy, calm. And we went up to Iceland. And, of course, going that far north, it was still light up 8, 9, 10 o'clock in the evening, and I thought this was a novelty to me. And then off we went and did our job around in patrolling the Denmark Straits. So that was the first experience I'd had of going to sea.
And what was that like?
Well,
were you seasick?
No, it was flat calm. But and then we did that trip, and we came back to Scapa Flow, and we went up and we did other things in Iceland, and we patrolled the gap between the Shetlands and Iceland. We did all sorts of things like that. But our first convoy, we had to go to Loch Hugh and pick the convoy up and then meet it and then go up to Iceland to fill up with fuel and wait for it to gain progress towards Russia, and then go out and meet it halfway to Russia. That journey from Scapa Flow to Iceland was the worst gale that there had ever been in 10 years, and it was absolutely horrendous. Ships were broken, ships ran out of food, ships ran out of fuel. The Sheffield, who was with us, had the top of a gun turret lifted off, and I was quite frightened. That was that, and we got over it.
How long did the storm last?
We were hove to for 12 hours. Hove to means you put your head into the sea and you just hold your position without making any attempt to make any progress. And everybody was blown, who were in company, were I would say, blown to the four winds.
What was it like inside?
Inside, you had a job to hold on. You never made a step without a handhold at the same time. Going up ladders was quite difficult because you'd be walking up this way and then suddenly you'd be walking up that way, and walking down ladders was even worse. And it was then that I learnt the trick of walking down sideways, always with a hand above you, so that if your feet slipped, and I'm talking about a companionway, if your feet slipped on the companionway, you would hang by your hand above your head. If your hands below you, you'd either break your arm or you'd just slide straight through. the decks were, even down in the warm part of the ship, the decks were always wet because water found its way in no matter what through the ventilation system and leaking portholes and people coming in with wet clothes and that sort of thing. It was always water about swimming across the floor. And this is where you had to be careful to keep your bedding dry, not allow anything to fall on the floor.